Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. Located at 6080 Falls Road, more information can be found at theivybookshop.com.
From the Baltimore Sun, I'm Dan Rodericks, Sun columnist and host of Roughly Speaking. This is episode 332 for Friday, December 8th. A busy show to take you through the weekend. Our film critics, Linda DeLibero and Christopher Llewellyn Reed, talk about Hollywood and the cascade of allegations of sexual abuse in the entertainment industry. Also, Linda and Chris recommend good films to see during the holiday season. And we take a few minutes to celebrate the late great character actor Claude Rains, famous for this line from Casablanca.
I'm shocked to find that gambling is going on in here.
Our appreciation of Claude Rains will come in the last part of today's show. Paula Gallagher, Baltimore County librarian and Roughly Speaking critic, lists books that will make good holiday gifts, and she does this by category, for the Instant Pot fanatic in your house, for instance, or the reluctant history buff, and the Stranger Things follower who needs something to read before season 3 starts. We'll hear from Paula in a few minutes. We start with Chris and Linda and the sexual abuse scandal that has ripped through the world of entertainment and the news media and American politics. From the disgraced producer Harvey Weinstein to actor Kevin Spacey, frequently seen around Baltimore during production of Netflix's House of Cards, to the comedian Louis C.K. The Los Angeles Times reports that the alleged misdeeds of powerful men have not only harmed numerous victims, but upended the livelihoods of hundreds of people who worked for them on various productions. The 200-member crew of House of Cards went on a paid hiatus after Netflix separated from Spacey. He was fired after allegations of inappropriate sexual behavior were raised by several men. Scotland Yard is also investigating sexual assault allegations made against Spacey when he was artistic director of the Old Vic in London. The House of Cards crew learned this week that another season of production would get underway, but without Spacey. Al Franken, the comedian who became a Democratic U.S. Senator from Minnesota, announced on Thursday that he would leave the Senate in the coming weeks after sexual harassment allegations surfaced. Chris Reed and Linda DeLibero were in the studio with me just a few hours after Franken made his announcement. They joined me monthly on the show, though not last month, so we had to catch up a bit. So Al Franken announces that he's going to resign from the U.S. Senate amidst these charges against him of sexual abuse, sexual harassment. Kevin Spacey, it looks like his career is over in Hollywood. And, of course, Harvey Weinstein. It seems like all of this cascade of stories about powerful men accused of sexual abuse, sexual harassment, sexually attacking women started with the big Weinstein story, which continues to grow in the New York Times because they continue to investigate him. So I wanted to talk to Linda and Chris about this because we haven't had a chance to on this podcast, and it certainly affects Hollywood. And it's kind of so weird to see the news from Los Angeles about this big fire raging toward the city of L.A. while all this has been going on in Hollywood.
It's like hellfire, the hellfire of retribution.
Linda, what are your reflections on this?
Oh, gosh. Your reflections change every other minute because the news just keeps piling on. And as you said that about, you know, we skipped November. The last time we were here, this had not even happened, or perhaps it had just begun to happen.
I think it had just begun. I think I sent you guys a note saying we probably ought to talk about Weinstein. But I don't know that Spacey had happened yet. But
no.
Anyway.
At this point, I feel a little bit of a sense of alarm because there is a kind of manic quality to this cascade of accusations, and people have talked about this, that there's a leveling of the attitude toward the charges. There's rape and sexual molestation and molesting an underage child, and then there's forcible kissing, and how do you equate these things? And I do think that's a very dangerous thing to do. I also think it's a very dangerous thing not to allow due process in this Franken case has me also very worried. And it's not because I don't believe his accusers. I think that there was going to be an ethics panel and that should have been carried out before he was forced to resign. Doing this sort of thing, I understand why the Democrats did it, because they're protecting themselves. This is a long game, I guess, is what they're playing here.
And in the immediate, they have the Roy Moore story in Alabama. So they have to counter that.
They're on higher ground.
Yeah, but higher ground than the president and Roy Moore.
But
right?
The problem is nobody said anything on the Democratic side when they called for Franken's resignation about Donald Trump or about Roy Moore, except for Franken himself, who was the last person who should have been pointing this out.
I, of all people, am aware that there is some irony in the fact that I am leaving while a man who has bragged on tape about his history of sexual assault sits in the Oval Office, and a man who has repeatedly preyed on young girls' campaigns for the Senate with the full support of his party.
Why didn't Kristen Gillibrand say something? Yes, we are calling him to account because we are taking the moral high ground. We believe this is important. Just as you, Republicans, have a moral obligation to ask our president to resign, who has done far more heinous things, admitted to them, said them on tape. And you are about to, you are, the RNC this week supported, gave monetary support to Roy Moore.
Yeah.
Of course, Trump is already.
Well, they have no standing anymore. They have none at all.
No, but so, call them to account. If you're going to call to account somebody who hasn't really had, I'm not saying he hasn't done anything, but I'm saying there hasn't been a due process. I mean, this leaves it to, okay, if you deny it and deny it and deny it, then nothing will happen to you. If you admit it, if you apologize for it, you're out. You're done. And I don't say this about Kevin Spacey or Harvey Weinstein, who did far more reprehensible things. There is a difference. The problem with this is, A, I think it is an insult to the women who have suffered truly egregious sexual crimes against them, who've had their careers ruined, who have suffered the trauma of rape or molestation or any kind of sexual attack that just at the very least has threatened their livelihood, to somebody who's been forcibly kissed, because I honestly don't know any woman who hasn't been forcibly kissed, and it's not the same thing. And the second thing is, it will, at some point, there's going to be harassment fatigue, and people are going to start using these instances against women, and this whole movement will come to a screeching halt. And the good that it has been able to do is not going to stick if there isn't a kind of, let's back away and let's start thinking and talking about what we're doing here.
Chris, from you.
Well, leaving politics aside for a moment and returning to the sexual misdeeds allegations, I think at least in Hollywood, what we may see is, once we have this sweeping cleansing fire, you may start to see these new shoots, as happens in a real fire, begin to grow of a healthier climate there. Now, I make no predictions, but I think there's a greater chance that we'll see things improve, at least in Hollywood, than we may in the political sphere, because there seems to be, ironically, since Hollywood is often accused of being a godless, hedonistic place, whereas politics is supposed to be the realm of the moral, I think we will see greater changes after all of this is done in Hollywood than we may in the political sphere.
That's the hope, that a new generation of actors, actresses, whoever works in Hollywood wouldn't have to put up with this crap in order to have a career.
Right. Now, I don't know if that's true, but certainly we're seeing so many people respond in ways that perhaps indicate that there will be a sea change, at least in that area, that there's hope there. And I am glad that horrible men like Harvey Weinstein and Kevin Spacey have been called to account.
Spacey's story is truly amazing, I find, because of the career that he had, and then suddenly it seemed like virtually overnight his career has ended. I mean, he's gone off apparently to seek therapy, we're told. House of Cards, which is produced here in Maryland, a lot of it filmed around Baltimore, will have another season. But without Kevin Spacey, do you see Spacey coming back from something like this?
People are saying that they think he can come back. And this is another instance of, it's kind of like James Levine. This is something that, I knew.
The Levine story, I remember reading a story about him and—
Ages ago.
20 years ago.
This is the conductor at the Met.
Yeah, right.
And I heard stories about Kevin Spacey 20 years ago where he had sex with young men who were acting with him in the theater, and he would tell them, if you dare say anything about this, I will ruin you. And I thought back then, you know, people would always come and say, oh, he's such a great actor. And I would think, oh, my God, he's a horrible human being. And if I knew about this, and I am not connected at all with the theater world, then I'm sure everybody in that world knew what was going on.
There was a story in The Guardian this week by Hadley Freeman, an essay, but referenced The Usual Suspects with Kevin Spacey, that apparently had to shut down for a while because of, quote-unquote, inappropriate sexual behavior by Spacey. And then they resumed production. And Hadley Freeman, writing in The Guardian, points out that The Usual Suspects was made in 1994, meaning it took, get out your calculator, 23 years before Spacey was finally called out on his widely known behavior. Remind me again, guys, how unfair life is for white men these days.
Yeah.
And now for whatever reason, did not know anything about Spacey, but nothing would surprise me in this world, and particularly not in Hollywood, because one thing we can be very certain of is that neither Spacey nor Weinstein nor any of the other men about whom allegations are being made are unique. There are, in the annals of Hollywood history, many, many reports of studio moguls, producers, and other powerful men behaving extremely inappropriately, if not actually, if not actually raping women who were within their sphere of influence. So this is hardly unique, and I do hope that there is a sea change in the culture.
Linda DeLibero and Chris Reed will be back later in the show to talk about the current cinema, share some Oscar buzz, and to celebrate the late, great character actor Claude Rains. So stay tuned for that. Paula Gallagher joins us next to recommend books that should make good holiday gifts for the foodies in your life, the history buffs, even the relative who enjoys correcting your grammar.
Hi, I'm Quinn Kelly, and I host a weekly podcast for the Baltimore Sun called Female Trouble. Each Tuesday, we feature a new long-form conversation with one of the area's most interesting and accomplished women, from public officials and congresswomen to rappers and restaurant owners. You can find Female Trouble on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Find more info at baltimoresun.com/femaletrouble.
And Quinn Kelly's most recent guest on Female Trouble is Sarah Autry, who plays bass, sings, and writes songs in the Baltimore band Wing Dam, a 90s-influenced guitar rock trio. Paula Gallagher recommends a book a week on the Roughly Speaking podcast, and at the end of each year, she makes a list of books that could make good gifts. And she does this by category, from books for the foodies in your family, or the Civil War buffs, or those who think history is boring and need to be shown otherwise. So you're a foodie and I'm a foodie. And we both love cookbooks, but it's sometimes a challenge for the person who's, you know, cooked a lot and seen a lot of cookbooks. So you have a category here, the person who needs some new go-to recipes.
Dan, Deb Perlman is absolutely one of my favorite home cooks there is. She's got a blog called Smitten Kitchen, and her new cookbook, this is her second, is called Smitten Kitchen Every Day, Triumphant and Unfussy New Favorites. And she is the friend you want to call, the friend that you want to hang out with, who's going to guide you in the kitchen. The recipes are very appealing. They're not difficult to make. She really tries her best to give you recipes that are going to give you the best results. And I can honestly say that a week doesn't go by that I'm not cooking something from Smitten Kitchen. And it's great to have this in book form. You get photos and you get her descriptions, again, just warm, humorous, terrific.
Keyword there, unfussy.
Yes.
Unfussy new favorites. Another category of cookbook, the person who's trying to eat less meat, you're recommending a Mark Bittman book.
Mark Bittman's classic, How to Cook Everything Vegetarian. This is the completely revised 10th anniversary edition.
Okay.
He's focusing some more on vegan recipes. It's got less cheese, fewer eggs. It's more health conscious. It's a book that doesn't sacrifice flavor. Bittman is good and clear and succinct in his directions. And it's not to be given to somebody who is a vegetarian necessarily. It's anyone who wants to eat a little bit better, anyone who wants to cook with more produce and maybe go meatless a couple days a week. This is a great place to go, and it's a good Bible to have in your kitchen.
Can I add one?
Sure.
David Tanis's Market Cooking. David Tanis was a guest on the podcast a couple of months ago, and his book is heavy on vegetables. That's why I like it. And I'm giving it as a gift to people in my family who are trying to eat less meat.
Fantastic.
David Tanis's Market Cooking. Another category for the home cook who wants to know why.
This book is called The Science of Cooking, Every Question Answered to Perfect Your Cooking. And it's by a food scientist, Dr. Stuart Faramund. And this is coming out from DK Publishers, Doreen Kinderly. And they're known for their heavily illustrated diagrammed books. And this is one of those. And it's great if you want to learn how to do things better and you find out the science behind them and what you can actually do to produce particular results. And so he goes into topics like caramelization. He talks about pressure cooking and how that works. Full page spread on how to make good fluffy mashed potatoes. How to make the perfect rice, grains that are not sticky and starchy and sticking together, but just right. There's a terrific full two-page spread on the process of how microwaving works. So anybody who has that kind of mind and is interested in the kitchen will really love this book.
God, this is a perfect book for my brother Joe.
Really?
He's a scientist, a chemist, and loves to cook. This sounds like a perfect book for Joe.
I think absolutely. And it's great. It'll teach you how to correct some of the mistakes that you've been making.
Hmm. Now, here's another one in the food category. This is a funny category. The Facebook friend who can't stop posting about their Instant Pot.
Now, Instant Pots have been around for a couple years, and they are the hot gift item. In fact, I just got one for my birthday.
There's so much about them right now.
Yes. And, you know, it harkens back to, of course, that pressure cooker, but this is the electric version, and it kind of combines the best things about a pressure cooker and a slow cooker. And this book is called Dinner in an Instant, 75 Modern Recipes for Your Pressure Cooker, Multi-Cooker, or Instant Pot.
And it's Melissa Clark.
Melissa Clark, who is highly regarded New York Times food reporter. Just clear, interesting, and really appealing things that you want to eat. Short ribs with a sort of Korean barbecue flavor. She gives things like how to make chicken soup, how to make beets, even how to make a cheesecake in the Instant Pot. And she explains that really, as long as you don't expect it to do something it can't do, it doesn't fry, it doesn't make things crispy, what you want are succulent foods. Mm-hmm. And it does those well, and it does it much quicker than if you were trying to do it on the stovetop or in the oven. And so this is a great way, or a companion gift to give somebody who might be getting an Instant Pot, or that person who's already been making some stuff, to give them some new ideas.
One more food category here. The history buff, who is also a foodie.
The Cooking Gene, A Journey Through African-American Culinary History in the Old South by Michael Twitty. Michael Twitty is a culinary and cultural historian. He's had a blog for a number of years. He's telling kind of a memoir family story. And it's a history of race, politics, economics, the influence of African culture and slavery on what we eat now. And he has a local tie. He currently lives in Silver Spring.
Now, here's a book recommendation from Paula for the relative who enjoys correcting your grammar.
This is A World Without Whom, The Essential Guide to Language.
I love that title.
It's The Essential Guide to Language in the BuzzFeed Age by Emily J. Favilla, and she is the BuzzFeed copy chief.
Huh.
So yes, it's BuzzFeed that you're seeing online with their top 10 lists and their clickbait. And really, this is a fun book for any grammarian, anyone who's interested in language and the evolution of our language and grammar. And now we're really talking about what it looks like to edit online and what it looks like to write for an online presence. And we're not throwing out traditional grammar, but we're making some tweaks. So this is a fun book to dip in and out of if you're interested in language.
Now, there's lots of Civil War books, lots of books about Lincoln. Actually, these books are about Ulysses Grant and two recommendations from Paula for the Civil War enthusiasts in your life.
Well, this would be an interesting duo to purchase for someone who's interested in Civil War or politics, or again, biography, history. Two very esteemed biography writers are focusing on Ulysses S. Grant. If last year was the year of Hamilton, this is the year of Grant. And I mention Hamilton because Ron Chernow's biography, Grant, he's the one who wrote the Alexander Hamilton biography that brought us the musical. American Ulysses, A Life of Ulysses S. Grant, is by Ronald C. White, who also, you mentioned Lincoln, did a biography of Lincoln. And he's focusing on the virtues, the moral courage of Ulysses S. Grant, brings you very close in, has done, both of these books represent a tremendous amount of research.
Paula has a cure for the person who thinks history is boring. This is a book that you raved about and others have too, Killers of the Flower Moon.
The subtitle of this book is The Osage Murders and the Birth of the FBI, and it's by David Gran, and he's known for writing The Lost City of Z. This came out a little earlier this year, and it was a finalist for the National Book Award in Nonfiction. And it delves, takes you back into the 1920s when the richest people in America were the Osage Indians in Oklahoma. And where did their money come from? It was because they were relocated to land that, for all appearances, looked highly undesirable, but underneath were great stores of oil. So the Osage Indians became very rich, and people noticed, and people took issue with that. But then the murders started to happen, and there were dozens of shocking murders at this time, and it's something that most people don't know about. It's certainly not something I knew about. And David Grand does a terrific job in making the story come alive. It's told in a suspenseful way, just the right amount of detail. And if you're not somebody who thinks they like history because maybe history has been very dry, this is not that book. It's a book
strong narrative.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And the birth of the FBI is no exaggeration. This case brought about the FBI, right?
It did.
Okay, for the naturalist in your life, in your family, someone who loves the outdoors, Paula recommends American Wolf.
The subtitle to this is A True Story of Survival and Obsession in the West. And Texas writer Nate Blakeslee is the author of this book. And he's taking a look at, of course, the wolf from the point of view of an alpha female in Yellowstone. And you see the wolf protect, the wolf give birth. And it ties into the story of wolves in the Rockies.
Love the next category. The friend who's waiting for season 3 of Stranger Things.
Well,
that would include me.
And that includes me, too. Yeah. And we've talked about this. And a really fun gift book this year is a book called Paperbacks from Hell. And it's the twisted history of 70s and 80s horror fiction. The author, Grady Hendrix, who is a horror fan and a horror writer himself, talks about that, what was the grand heyday of horror. We had things like The Exorcist and Rosemary's Baby. And of course, when something big hits, there are people who are trying to cash in on that success and write their own books. And so horror took a page from romance and started publishing these pulp paperbacks, the very inexpensive 25-cent copies, the books that yellowed as you looked at them. And he puts them into categories. He does some reviews, but you hear about satanic cults and possessed dolls and demon children. He delves into human behavior. And so a lot of this is going to remind you of that time period in Stranger Things and, of course, the forces that happened in that show. He gives recommendations and he, you know, delves into some gothic horror writers like V.C. Andrews, who is still writing past her death, and the very beloved R.L. Stine, who wrote the Goosebumps and continues to write the Goosebumps series. So that's a great gift book.
You have a second one in that category, Strange Weather, 4 short novels by Joe Hill.
And Dan, if you don't know by now, Joe Hill is the son of Stephen King. And he was, of course, what everyone was reading when they were a middle schooler or a high schooler in the 1980s and continuing till now. And Joe Hill certainly has his father's talent. He's great at finding the horror in the everyday. He trades on nostalgia, and he finds the human details in the horror, and you're getting four distinct stories, all that will pull you in, and some that are going to give you that same feeling as when you're watching Stranger Things.
Has he written a book with his father?
Don't believe he has. His other brother, Owen, has a new book out with his father called Sleeping Beauty currently.
The person who was horrified by the relevance of The Handmaid's Tale.
Yes, and this is another, you know, TV can influence what you want to read. This is a literary novel called The Power by Naomi Alderman. And it's an award winner. It just won the Bailey's Women's Prize for Fiction. And this book focuses on young women who are becoming aware that they have electrostatic abilities. So they're able to send electric energy through their bodies, through their fingertips, and it's something that seems to be happening all of a sudden. The girls are realizing they have the power, 13 or 14-year-old girls. Science is studying them, trying to figure out what's going on. There's a visible, almost structure in the body called the skein, which is where this energy is coming from, and younger women can help older women to ignite this power. Hmm. So there are multiple narrators in the novel, and the author does a terrific job in the what if. And what if these women have this power? So some are using it for self-defense. Some are using it to escape situations, some for revenge, some tie into sex. It's happening all over the globe. A religion has come up because this is the power of the matriarchy. It's very much a novel of 2017, and it almost feels like a reaction to all these women who are coming forward to talk about things that have happened to them, the sexual abuse. However, clearly it was written before all that happened, so it's a very prescient novel.
Oh, that sounds really interesting.
Yes, The Power.
By Naomi Alderman.
Yes.
So you know someone who's in a book club, and you want to give them a book with a note that says, hey, this might be good for your book club. So here we go. There's two titles. Pachinko by Min Jin Lee. I remember you raving about this one.
Yes, this is a Korean family saga. And, you know, if you're the type of person who likes to read about another culture, who likes a window in another world, who wants to learn something as they're reading, and I like that too, this is a terrific book with well-drawn characters that, again, takes you through multiple generations. And Pachinko is that parlor game, similar to it, sort of like an upright pinball. And it figures into the family's way of being able to make a living. So very interesting and very engrossing book. Min Jin Lee's Pachinko.
It'd be a lot of material for a book club.
Yes, lots to discuss.
And Stay With Me.
Stay With Me is by a Nigerian novelist, Ayobami Adebayo. And this takes place in the early 2000s and looking back into the 1980s, a young woman who is unable to give her husband children and a domineering mother-in-law who's decided her husband should take a second wife. And so it's a book that really delves into themes of all kinds of love, romantic, familial, and brings up a lot of family secrets and ultimately what would you do for your husband, what would you do to have a child and keep the child.
Now, the last category, I'm interested in how you came up with this, the best reason to give a gift card.
Well, I, of course, get to read advanced copies of books that are coming out, and I get to hear pitches from publishers. And this is The Woman in the Window by A.J. Finn. This is the thriller that everyone is going to be talking about, and tantalizingly, it comes out just after Christmas.
Okay.
The release date is January 2nd. It's a very cost.
I see. So you won't be able to give the book.
Exactly.
So give a card, give a gift card or something.
Exactly. Yeah. If you were a fan of books like Gone Girl or The Girl on the Train, it's getting a lot of great advance buzz, and it's the book you'll want to get with that gift card.
It's the one people will be talking about early in the new year.
Yes.
Paula, this is great. I appreciate you doing this.
Thank you, Dan.
It was nice to be able to review some of the books you talked about on the podcast during this past year. And thank you for all your contributions to the show, and have a great holiday.
You too. Thank you.
If you didn't get all the titles Paula mentioned, look for a link in the notes with this podcast to a blog post at BaltimoreSun.com. It's all there. You'll see them all there, along with books in a couple of other categories, books for people who like stories about time travel, for instance, or pop music, or biographies of great artists. Okay, now to the second part of our conversation with film critics Linda DeLibero and Christopher Llewellyn Reed. With the sexual abuse allegations hanging over Hollywood and wildfires near Los Angeles, we can still look through the smoke to see what Tinseltown produced this year, what films are being buzzed about for Oscars, what's good in the current cinema, which movies are going into release over the coming holidays, and, as is our custom here, we spend some time on Hollywood history. Today, with an appreciation of the great character actor, Claude Rains. Well, a pall over Hollywood, or lots of smoke over Hollywood, and fire raging. It's December. This is usually when we talk about the best films of the year, what the Oscar buzz is. Why don't we do a little bit on this anyway, because it's the last time to be together before the end of the year with Chris and Linda. And so I'd like to hear what you have to say about Oscar buzz and the current cinema. So.
And what does one go to the movies for, if not for escape?
Yeah, I went to see Wonder Woman this year for that reason, and Thor, complete escapism.
Good escape
really,
is fun.
Really
yeah.
enjoyed myself.
And Wonder Woman is, of course, the great feminist superhero yeah. film that we needed, and it made a killing at the box office, and
yeah.
that's wonderful. And speaking of that, a few films that are in the front runner position for Best Picture are films directed by women. One of them is the film Lady Bird, directed by actress-turned-director in her directorial debut, Greta Gerwig. And then there's also Mudbound by Dee Reese, which, interestingly, got a dual release on both Netflix, so you can watch it right now.
Okay.
But it was also released simultaneously in select theaters because still right now, to qualify for the Academy Awards, you have to have a two-week release minimum in the theaters. So those are two of the front runners. And then there are other films like Call Me By Your Name by Luca Guadagnino that is yet to open in our area but will soon. Dunkirk, of course, from this summer. Get Out, the film by Jordan Peele made yep. earlier this year.
Mm-hmm.
A film, Phantom Thread, by Paul Thomas Anderson that won't come out in Baltimore until January but is already playing in select markets. The Post.
Oh.
And then there's The Shape of Water, which will be released in Baltimore a week from this Friday, so December 15th. And that is a beautiful, visual, lush period piece about a romance between basically the creature from the Black Lagoon and a mute woman during the Cold War.
What's the best picture of the year in your view? What
Dunkirk.
Would you say? Dunkirk
yeah,
was really good, wasn't it?
I love
it?
Dunkirk.
I agree. Well, how about you, Chris?
I'm going to answer that with two films. One is a small film that probably very few people have seen. It's gotten very limited release, but I want to give it a shout out if you ever see it streaming near you. It's called Easy Living. But then in terms of stuff that's actually made it to a theater near you, I would probably have to go with Lady Bird, which for me is just a wonderful coming-of-age tale. I think it's beautifully acted, beautifully written, beautifully edited, and beautifully shot.
And you have a clip from it.
I do.
So do what you do so well here on the podcast and set that up for us.
I will do what I do so well. So this is from the opening.
Among the many things that you do so well. Yeah,
this is the opening of the film where we have Laurie Metcalf as the mother of the main character who has given herself the name Lady Bird, which is not her real name. So we have Laurie Metcalf, of course, who many people know from the show Roseanne, Saoirse Ronan, the marvelous Irish actress who was in Brooklyn.
Brooklyn, yeah.
They're coming back from a college visit because she's a senior in high school, and they're having an argument about her college choices. And at the end of this clip, they hear the mother scream because Lady Bird throws herself out of the car while it's moving.
I want to go where culture is, like
how
New
in the
York,
world did I raise such a
or at least
snob.
Connecticut or New Hampshire,
really,
where writers live in the
get
woods.
Get into those schools anyway.
Mom.
You can't even pass your driver's test.
Because you wouldn't let me practice
the way
enough.
That you work, or the way that you don't work, you're not even worth state tuition, Christine.
My name is Lady Bird.
Well, actually, it's not, and it's ridiculous.
Call me Lady Bird like
Christine.
You said you would.
You should just go to City College. You know, with your work ethic, just go to City College and then to jail and then back to City College, and then maybe you'd learn to pull yourself up and not expect everybody to do everything.
Linda, you mentioned Dunkirk. We both really like Dunkirk. So it looks like the bookend movie to that is The Darkest Hour with Gary Oldman as Winston Churchill. Chris, did you see that film?
I did see The Darkest Hour starring Gary Oldman as Winston Churchill. People should see it if they like Gary Oldman and if they like these kinds of
Churchill.
Stories. Yes, I'll just leave it at that. It hasn't come out yet, right. So I don't want to give a review, but we'll just leave it at
New
that.
New Yorker had a great piece about the number of actors who've played Winston Churchill in various films over the years, but concluded that
Churchill actually played himself better than anybody, and he was practicing it. Yeah. He actually studied the theater a bit, or studied actors,
right,
in order to be an effective communicator.
Sure. You know who I thought was a terrible Churchill? Was John Lithgow on The Crown.
Oh, I didn't think he was so bad. Right. He's just too tall. That's the problem. Wasn't it that he was too tall?
Maybe.
I didn't think he was so bad. Speaking of The Crown, the second season of The Crown is upon us, and a Netflix series about Queen Elizabeth, and I really liked it the first season, and I'll probably watch the second season. And I just read in the New York Times that it's 60 parts.
Wow.
It's scheduled to be, what, 6 seasons of 10 parts? That's amazing. It's going to go through the whole life of Queen Elizabeth. It just begs a question. I know you mentioned a film earlier that it's a Netflix film that had a release in theaters.
Mudbound.
Is that going to happen more often? Like, you know, Stranger Things, right? Stranger Things, so popular. Why couldn't the theaters, especially independent theaters, say to Netflix, hey, you know, can we show that in over a week's time, or over, can we have a binge weekend where people will come in and watch a series like that in our movie theater? We'll, of course, make a deal with you. What's going to keep that from happening? I mean, people, if something's popular and you want to see it on a big screen in a movie theater, it sounds kind of exciting to me.
Well, I think it's worth trying. I'm not convinced there's an appetite for that, because I think now we're getting so used to seeing good long-form dramas in our homes on our nice, fairly wide TVs.
Pretty big TVs.
I think if a theater wants to try that, but I'm not convinced there's an appetite for that. But there's certainly...
But you get the group... See, it's a group experience,
it's a communal viewing experience.
Right. Think, especially Stranger Things, right?
You're talking about young people, I think it could happen. Kids, college kids, maybe even high school kids, people who are up to the age of 30, I could see that happening. Or maybe old people, too.
You could make it an event. It'd be like Anglophiles, older folks who are Anglophiles who like... say, Downton Abbey or The Crown.
It's the only thing that you could have that would replicate that, you know, Monday morning water cooler discussion about, you know, Thursday night NBC comedy, you know, Cheers.
Right.
Those days. People long for those days.
Seinfeld was another one.
Like right.
That. I'm not convinced that young people would. I mean, my students anyway don't go to the movies that often, so... I think it would be actually be people 30 and above who grew up with the theatrical experience who might be more motivated. But I could be wrong.
If you marketed it as an event, it's like opening night of the latest Star Wars film or something.
Sure.
A lot of folks turn out because they're so deeply into it.
Right, but that's an event movie. Right, so you'd have to market it that way.
This is a Stranger Things weekend.
Sure.
The bottom line is theaters are going to have to try stuff like that because it's so difficult to sustain.
That's why I brought it up.
Yeah.
Because
we
had a conversation a couple of months ago about this very thing.
We did.
What's going to happen to the box office.
And before we talk about films that are playing, you asked me to mention a series we were talking about earlier, speaking of Netflix series, which is Godless, which is playing on Netflix, which is a Western series I had mentioned to you as something I really, really liked.
But, and I'm going to mention the marvelous Mrs. Maisel on Amazon, which I really, really like.
I look forward to seeing that.
Yeah.
But there is a lot of great stuff in theaters.
Okay, I wanted to ask you about The Disaster Artist.
You bet. So that opens on December 8th at the Charles Theater in Baltimore. And that is a film it's a very good film about the making of a very bad film. It's about the making of the 2003 film The Room, which was directed by a novice director, Tommy Wiseau, or Wiseau, as I've heard his name pronounced, a man of mysterious origins and in every way, where he's from, where does his money come from, how old is he?
This is all fictional, right?
It's a real film. In 2003, there was a film released called The Room, which has become a cult classic ever since then because it's considered one of the worst films ever made.
Oh, I'm sorry, I've missed that.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so James Franco and his brother Dave Franco both star, and Franco produced and James directed a movie based on the book about the making of the film. So the book was called The Disaster Artist. It was written by one of the people who starred in The Room, Greg Sestero, and it's a hilarious retelling of the making of this completely inept movie. The clip I brought features this moment in the film where Tommy Wiseau, who wrote the script, cannot remember his line. And you hear James Franco, you hear Dave Franco, who's playing his best friend, and you hear Seth Rogen as the script supervisor who's directing the scene since Tommy Wiseau is in it.
Action! What line? I did not hit her. It's not true. It's bullshit. I did not hit her. I did not. Oh, hi, Mark.
Okay.
Action.
What is the line?
I did not hit her. It's not true. It's bullshit. I did not hit her. I did not. Oh, hi, Mark. Scene 112, take 13. Mark it. Action.
I did not hit her. Okay, line.
I did not hit her. It's not true. It's bullshit. I did not hit her. I did not. Oh, hi, Mark. Take 17, action.
I hit her.
No. Do you want to change the line?
Script is script. Script says same.
You're doing great, man.
That sounds really good, Chris. So December 8th, we'll hit the Charles?
That's right.
Great. What did you think of Coco?
Oh, you know, I saw it twice, and both times I cried.
Okay,
and
that's pretty good.
Yeah, that's the Disney Pixar film.
Really?
Yeah.
You cried the second time as well?
I did, because, you know, Pixar does this. They get you. They know how to manipulate you. And the worst thing about this film, if you don't like to cry in movies, is that just as I was getting myself together after the first episode sent me down that road, 5 minutes later, a follow-up scene happens, and I was just, no, I must not cry. I am real man. I shed no tears. I'm being silly. Of course, men can cry. But that's a film I highly recommend. And
there's, it's been on my list since Thanksgiving. Yeah. I better get out to see it.
And, you know, there are lots of other good films playing. We mentioned Lady Bird. We mentioned Mudbound. There's a great documentary you can see on Netflix as well, which has gotten a very brief theatrical release. It's called Jim and Andy. It's about Jim Carrey making Man on the Moon, where he thought he was basically possessed by the spirit of Andy Kaufman. And then soon, coming out next week, we have Guillermo del Toro's The Shape of Water, which is just, you know, a beautiful, beautiful film. Call Me by Your Name, we mentioned that earlier, by Luca Guadagnino. You mentioned Darkest Hour, which comes out at the 22nd of December at the Charles. And then Star Wars Episode 8, The Last Jedi, opens on December 15th, and that will probably be the blockbuster film of the season.
We were originally scheduled to do this podcast in November, on November 10th, and we always look to see, on these dates when we get together, Chris, Linda, and I, if they're significant Hollywood-wise. And we found two birthdays on November 10th. Ennio Morricone, the great Italian composer of soundtracks of films, music for movies. And Claude Rains, the actor Claude Rains, who was born in 1889 on November 10th. So we didn't want to let that go, because Claude Rains is really an interesting figure in Hollywood history.
Victor Laszlo, you're under arrest on a charge of accessory to the murder of the couriers from whom these letters were stolen.
We wanted to hear from Linda on Claude Rains. Was Claude Rains American or was he British?
He was British.
When I listened to his voice...
Stop where you are. You don't know what you're doing.
His accent and where he plays an American.
This is a man's world, Jeff, and you got to check your ideals outside the door like you do your rubbers.
Is he just being stentorian in his delivery?
Yes.
Or was he actually British?
He was British.
Okay.
I found it very interesting to read about his life, because his background was extremely similar to both Charlie Chaplin's and Cary Grant's. He is somebody who really constructed his persona out of thin air. Started off as a Cockney in London, very poor family, basically ran away and joined the circus kind of thing. Mother was put into a mental institution, and the father was a ne'er-do-well actor. This was Claude Rains' story. So he did not come from the place where his voice would suggest that he came from, but worked his way up in the theater as a way first to make money. He was, you know, he was the kind of kid who hung around the theater, and then he became a prompter, and then worked his way up to theater manager. And one of the actors he worked for said, "Did you ever think about acting?" He had a very bad stutter, so this mentor trained him to...
In diction?
Yep. Just trained the stutter out of him. And he was on his way in small parts, and then World War I broke out. He served. He was hit by a mortar. He was blinded permanently in one eye. If you know this and you start looking at his performances, you can see he always wore his hair kind of over that one eye. And I mean, you would never know it if you didn't know it.
I think you see that in Casablanca.
A little bit. If you're looking for it, you'll see it.
Okay, okay.
But the other thing that happened was his vocal cords were damaged.
Damaged in the war?
And he couldn't speak for quite a while. And when he came out of it, finally, luckily, it's pretty bad to lose your voice as an actor, he had this kind of gruff sound to his voice that hadn't been there before. So it actually ended up adding to the repertoire of voices that he could use.
I think you hear that in The Invisible Man.
Mm-hmm.
You bring me near madness with your peering through the keyholes and gaping through the curtains, and now you'll suffer for it.
Now, his voice in The Adventures of Robin Hood.
Sir Robin of Locksley. Well, I've heard precious little else since I've been here. What's his latest outrage?
There's an interesting story behind Claude Rains, yeah. That one.
He consciously played the king, John. Oh, no, he isn't the king yet. Oh, yes, he does. He steals the throne from Richard, right?
But I think you're right. I think he's Prince John.
He's Prince John, yeah. But he aspires to be King John, and right. I think he just takes it.
this is the Errol Flynn Robin
yes,
Hood, right?
Yes, correct. Yeah. It's such a great movie. If you watch it, you will realize that everything in it is stuff that Spielberg and Lucas and all these guys who watched serials, they were watching this too, because it's such a wonderful adventure film.
Okay, so what about Claude's voice in this?
So he plays John as gay. And when I watched it again this time, and I hadn't read about this, and I thought, wow, he's really kind of fey and, a little effeminate.
Yeah.
And he did it consciously, but he modeled his voice, his diction, and his manner after Bette Davis, his frequent co-star.
Any more objections to the new tax from our Saxon friends?
Objections, Your Highness. With a Saxon dangling from every gallows tree between here and Charnwood?
Well said, Sir Knight, but not too many mind. Else we'll have nobody left to till our land or pay the tax.
There's one exception I'd make, Your Highness. A certain Saxon noble.
Who is that?
Sir Robin of Locksley.
An impudent, reckless rogue who goes around the shire stirring up the Saxons against authority.
I could have captured him long ago, but...
But what?
Well, he's the deadliest archer in England, and...
My brave High Sheriff of Nottingham is afraid of him. I want him taken and hanged. At once, do you hear?
That's very interesting. Was Claude Rains gay?
Nope.
Okay.
He was married 5 times. I mean, certainly not that anybody knew. When we were thinking about segues from sexual harassment to Claude Rains, like, how do you get there? I made a joke and said, yeah, he was probably one of them. Everybody was. I have no idea.
And he certainly plays one in Casablanca.
Let's talk about that, because he plays...
Louis, the chief of police.
Louis, the chief of police, right?
I'm shocked to find that gambling is going on in here.
And he manipulates women into giving him sex in return for passage out of Casablanca, right?
Yeah, that's pretty... That's about as bad as you can get.
Yeah.
And yet, because he's played by Claude Rains, and because the script gives him the best lines... We like him.
Mm-hmm.
And his trajectory in the film is really one of going from being this, horrible, hedonistic, cynical guy to being a freedom fighter. So he at least is headed in the right direction.
I brought the money, Mr. Blaine.
Keep it. You'll need it in America.
But we made a deal.
Now, never mind that. You won't have any trouble in Lisbon, will you?
No, it's all arranged.
Good. I've got the letters right here, all made out in blank. All you have to do is fill in the signatures.
Victor Laszlo, you're under arrest on a charge of accessory to the murder of the couriers from whom these letters were stolen. Oh, you're surprised about my friend Ricky. The explanation is quite simple. Love, it seems, has triumphed over virtue.
Not so fast, Louis. Nobody's going to be arrested, not for a while yet.
Have you taken leave of your senses?
I have. Sit down over there.
Put that gun down.
Louis, I wouldn't like to shoot you, but I will if you take one more step.
Under the circumstances, I will sit down.
Keep your hands on the table.
I suppose you know what you're doing, but I wonder if you realize what this means.
I do. We've got plenty of time to discuss that later.
Call off your watchdogs, you said.
Just the same, you call the airport and let me hear you tell them. And remember, this gun is pointed right at your heart.
That is my least vulnerable spot.
Now, in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, directed by Frank Capra, Claude Rains plays a senior senator who's trying to tell the young senator, played by Jimmy Stewart, that he needs to adapt to Washington, that he needs to compromise that he can't always have it the way he thinks he can. His idealism is admirable, but it doesn't last in Washington. But I want to say the voice of Claude Rains in this.
30 years ago, I had your ideals.
Gave me an idea when I was a kid about how proper gentlemen spoke and behaved. I'm not talking about the moral of the story. I'm just talking about how you dressed, the manners that you expressed. I remember getting all of this from Claude Rains in that film. And he's an old white guy with white hair and glasses, but look where he is. He's a senator, and this is how you're supposed to behave in life, right? Mm-hmm. This is some old idea I had when I was a kid when I first saw this. But then you realize that when you get into the meat of this story, Mr. Smith goes to Washington, that and look how topical it is today, basically selling yourself out, selling off your idealism in bits and pieces in order for you to maintain power.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he was wonderful in this role because we think of him as this intensely civilized
gentleman. That's it, intensely
gentleman.
Civilized, yeah.
Mm-hmm. The veneer of civilization, however, is quite thin, and beneath that surface there reeks corruption. I mean, he reeks of corruption. It's that speech that he gives is such, it's chilling, absolutely chilling, because there is this dichotomy between what he appears to be and what he really is. And what could be more pertinent when we have all of these people who claim to be so proper and religious and
virtuous,
upholding the values
virtuous
of our country?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Of course, there are exceptions to that in high office right now. I can think of some people who are very proud of their uncivilized behavior. But by and large, the senator is a prestigious figure who speaks very eloquently, and of course, Mr. Smith, the worst thing that happens to him is that his hero has feet of clay, to say the least.
Can a man like Taylor tell you and those other men what to do? Now, listen, Jeff, please, and try to understand. Now, 30 years ago, I had your ideals. I was you. I had to make the same decision you were asked to make today. And I made it. I compromised. Yes. So that all those years I could sit in that Senate and serve the people in 1,000 honest ways. You've got to face facts, Jeff. I've served our state well, haven't I? We have the lowest unemployment and the highest federal grants. But, well, I've had to compromise. I've had to play ball. You can't count on people voting. Half the time they don't vote anyway. That's how states and empires have been built since time began. Don't you understand?
The last Claude Rains film that we'll mention and recommend to folks is Notorious. And you mentioned Cary Grant earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Cary Grant appears in this film. Could you set this up? Because we're going to listen to a clip from it. But can you set this up for us a little bit, what the story is about?
Yeah, it's one of my favorite Hitchcock films because it's a very dark movie. Cary Grant is ostensibly the hero who is recruiting Ingrid Bergman, who's a fallen woman, to spy for the U.S. government. And they fall in love, and he becomes an absolute unbearable hypocrite. He will not accept her because of her past. Meanwhile, Claude Rains is the guy they're spying on because they suspect he's leading a Nazi gang in South America. She knew him prior to meeting Cary Grant, so she's the perfect cover. She's going to seduce Claude Rains, who's already madly in love with her, and actually has to marry him, basically prostituting herself, even though she loves Cary Grant. So what we have here is a pretty despicable Cary Grant and a villain, Claude Rains, who is actually much more likable and much more human and much more deferential, at least in the beginning, to Ingrid Bergman. And in this scene, they all encounter each other at the racetrack. She's having a clandestine meeting with Grant to tell him what the spy story is. And Claude Rains comes in and is quite jealous of Grant and suspects that there's something more going on between them than meets the eye.
Snap out of it. Here comes Dreamboat.
Oh, hello, Alex.
was so exciting, a beautiful horse. Do you remember Mr. Devlin?
How do you do?
Hello. Alicia tells me you had a bet on number 10. Sorry I didn't get the tip earlier. So long.
See you sometime, Deb. It was a wonderful race. Did you have much money on the winner?
I didn't see the race.
Didn't you? I thought I saw you looking through your field glasses.
I was watching you and your friend, Mr. Devlin. I presume that's why you left my mother and me. You had an appointment to meet him.
Don't be absurd. I met him purely by accident.
You didn't seem very anxious to get away from him.
Oh, he's just...
I watched you. I thought maybe you're in love with him.
Don't talk like that. I detest him.
Really? He's very good looking.
Alex, I've told you before, Mr. Devlin doesn't mean a thing to me.
I'd like to be convinced. Would you maybe care to convince me, Alicia, that Mr. Devlin means nothing to you?
I just want to second Linda's praise for this film and for virtually all of Claude Rains's performances. I have been a lifelong fan of the movie Casablanca, despite some issues I have with certain parts of it as I get older. But I love Claude Rains's performance in that film. I love how he makes us, just like he does in Notorious, like a deeply amoral character. Claude Rains has been one of my favorite, you know, let's call him a character actor since he was never really a leading man of Hollywood's golden age.
It's fun to celebrate him because I'm sure there are people who remember him, and then I think there are a lot of younger people who have no idea who he is, and he was such a remarkably versatile actor. I think Notorious is his greatest role because he really is so subtly able to color every character he plays with a number of shades of darkness and light and respectability. And people actually, I think it was John Gielgud who actually was, he was a kind of mentor to, he said he was both self-effacing and grandiose. Mm. And I think that's a great description of some of the things that he was able to do on the screen.
Chris, thank you very much. Linda, thank you, and happy holidays. Merry Christmas to you.
Thanks, Dan. Holidays. Happy holidays.
I don't have to just say happy holidays. I can say Merry Christmas, right?
Yes.
And Happy New Year. So I'll see you in January, and then we'll see where things are. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Dan.
Thanks.
Linda DeLibero is director of the program in Film and Media Studies at Johns Hopkins University. And Christopher Llewellyn Reed is professor and chair of Stevenson University's Film and Moving Image Department. They join us once a month to talk about the movies, about Hollywood of the past, as well as the current cinema. Signing off today with Ennio Morricone's theme from The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. And that's our show for Friday and the weekend. I hope you enjoyed it. Comments are always welcome. Please review the show on iTunes if you get a chance to do that. The producers of Roughly Speaking are Steve Early and Quinn Kelly. This is Dan Rodericks here at the Baltimore Sun. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking. We'll see you again soon. Have a great weekend.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. Located at 6080 Falls Road, more information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966.